a lot of the same things happen in WWE as far as, I have to know how to navigate the media and do a lot of the same things as far as, kind of public outreach that I do in the mayor's office. And frankly, also be able to get along with people. When we think about politics per se in government, I think what folks have to understand is that there's politics in everything we do as human beings.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. I've got a great guest to bring to you this week. With me today is Mayor Glenn Jacobs, who you might know as the former WWE star, Kane. Mr. Mayor, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Brad. Appreciate you having me on.
So I think it's fair to say that you have a pretty unique life journey and career path. So just to start, how did you go from being a WWE star, a wrestler, to ending up in politics?
Well, I've always been interested in government and politics. And my kind of life story is I grew up on a farm in Missouri, in rural Missouri. And growing up, I always saw sports as my pathway to a better, more fluent life. And my folks worked really hard. My dad was a retired military. He was in the military for 21 years. My mom was a homemaker. They worked really hard, but we didn't always have a whole lot, and sometimes had to make the decision about whether to get the car fixed or to pay some other bill. And I didn't want to live kind of paycheck to paycheck. I mean, like I said, always had something to eat and always had a place over our head and all that. And I saw sports as my pathway to a better life, frankly. And after a lot of twists and turns, eventually I got into professional wrestling and found a lot of success in that. I was very fortunate and very blessed to do that. And when I look back on my life, I'm like, man, how could someone like me who grew up where I did and, didn't really have like any great prospects for being able to do many of the really awesome things that I've been able to do, been so fortunate to do, how could that happen? And I think the reason is because I grew up in a country and I live in a country where those opportunities are available to pretty much everybody. If you have the talent, it's not guaranteed, but you have the opportunity that maybe you can really live the life of your dreams, no matter what you pursue, whether it's in my case, professional wrestling or anything else, and whatever that means to you as an individual. And as I got older and realized that that was under continual threat. And the biggest threat, of course, is government. And to me, that's what the American dream is all about, is just opportunity to live the life that you want to create. And I got into government because I wanted to do my best to ensure that people like my kids, my grandkids, and the next generation also have the opportunity to live the life that they want to live.
Yeah, that's a very compelling story. But people might think of these two chapters of your life as very distinct. But is there anything that's similar about politics to WWE wrestling and fighting?
Well, sure. I mean, really, I think when we look at life overall, our ability to relate to people on an interpersonal level, our people skills is vitally important. And a lot of the same things happen in WWE as far as, I have to know how to navigate the media and do a lot of the same things as far as, kind of public outreach that I do in the mayor's office. And frankly, also be able to get along with people. When we think about politics per se in government, I think what folks have to understand is that there's politics in everything we do as human beings. I mean, anytime you're in a social setting, at work, wherever, there's politics involved. Government is different because it literally is politics. And, there's a lot of money and a lot of power involved with that. Nevertheless, throughout life, everything we do is really somehow based around politics. So I think that just having the ability to navigate the politics of WWE, and there are some politics involved there, somewhat helped me in this role.
So that's one thing I'd like to ask about, because in a lot of sports, the climate is very left-wing or very left-leaning. Sure. You think of the NBA, you think of the NFL. there's kind of a left-wing orthodoxy, but what's the culture like in WWE? I know it has maybe a more conservative fan base. Is that reflected in kind of the sport at large?
I think it's mixed. Of course, WWE CEO and president, Vince McMahon and Donald Trump are friends. They go way back. They've actually been business partners in some ventures with WWE, some of the early WrestleManias. Linda McMahon was Trump's small business administrator. So there's definitely a connection there. I think throughout the roster, it's really mixed when you have people that are on either side. One thing that, and this is true of other sports too, I assume, but in WWE, we're not employees of WWE. The performers are independent contractors, which means that we're responsible for paying withholding tax and all the other stuff that you would normally see an employee do. So if I were to ever become president, my first act would be, if I had the power to do this, but I assume that if someone like me ever became president, I'd quickly learn how little power the president is actually supposed to have. But if I were the president, I would eliminate withholding tax, and I would actually make people write a check to the IRS, because then folks would realize how much money they're actually handing over to the federal government. And we would no longer look at a tax refund as, oh, I'm getting money back from the government. They realize, oh my goodness, I've paid all this money in, and in most cases I'm getting very little out. And I think they take a much closer look at what government actually does, especially the federal government, with the amount of money that it receives.
So it's a good idea. And one thing I've heard that maybe you'd appreciate is, not only do you make people sit down and write their taxes in a check to the government in one lump sum, you do it the day before the election.
That's right. Exactly.
Right. So with that in mind, people have probably picked up on this by now, but if not, if they know anything about you, you're more on the libertarian side of the Republican and conservative spectrum. So how did you come to find that framework in the first place?
I had always, I switched a lot throughout my life as far as what I believed. And my parents were what I would kind of call Goldwater conservatives, Goldwater Republicans. We didn't really talk about politics that much, but from the discussions that they would have with people or that I would overhear, I knew where they were on things. I remember one of my earliest memories, it's really strange, was driving next to some of the high voltage power lines, like the high tension power lines. And my mom saying, how bad eminent domain was and government condemning people's property and taking from them. And I was like 5 years old. Right. And so that may have colored me the rest of my life. As I got to college, even back then, there's a pretty leftist bias in many of the classes. And then, so I was like, okay, well, maybe the government should be doing all these things and all that. And then I got out and I got into the real world and I realized, oh my goodness, government should not be doing a lot of the things that it does. So it's just, I just switched around a lot. And then finally, I was talking with a friend of mine and I said that I didn't know what I was, because I agreed with the conservatives and the people on the right. And this is 20 years ago. This is when the culture wars were really, really going on. I agreed with a lot of people on the right as far as taxation and that sort of thing. At the same point in time, I mean, what people do in their personal life, as long as they're not hurting anyone else, I don't care. And he said I sounded like a libertarian. And I was like, dude, if you call me a name again, we're going to fight, okay? Because I'd never heard the term libertarian before. And I actually did some research. I went to the LP website, the Libertarian Party website, and I was like, okay, this is interesting, because they kind of do see, I don't want to say middle ground, but they, I agreed with a lot more of what they were saying than maybe either I would the other parties at that point, as far as like when I would look at the issues, okay? But I was kind of like what I call ad hoc libertarian. I just thought, okay, well, I agree with them on this issue, so I agree with them on that issue. But then I started looking more into the philosophy and I was like, okay, I get it now. We all own ourselves, and the property we own is an extension of the ownership that we have in our lives. And no one has the right to trespass against us, even if they belong to a large group saying that they're government, the non-aggression acts and all that. And then I branched out into everything, and finally discovered Austrian economics because I heard like people like Ron Paul and these different folks that I really respected were all talking about Austrian economics, and got to study that and realized I'd never taken an economics class in college. So I was very, because math, so I was very intimidated by economics, and I started reading the Austrian school, and I was like, wait a second, they're not talking about math and equations and predictive science. They're actually talking about people and human action and what people do. And that makes a lot more sense to me. And that kind of sealed the deal all the way. And I realized that really it's all about economics. And, you know, it's all about how we utilize our time and how we utilize our life, which in a way is economic decisions. So that's kind of summing it up. And you know, and it's a journey that took me decades to finalize, actually. And I'm the one I'm still on.
So that's an interesting point, right? Because with libertarians, when they do support government action on a variety of things, they generally want it to be closer, right? They believe in federalism, state and local government know what's best for their people better than the feds do. As a unique combination of a mayor and a libertarian Republican, how do you view the proper role of city and municipal government?
I absolutely agree with that. And when we think about federalism and even within the state, representation at a much more local level, and don't get me wrong, of course, there can be issues with that. But nevertheless, I absolutely disagree with that statement that government that's closer to people is better. And we see that here. You know, I actually have my finger on the pulse of my community, and I know what's going on because I get to talk to people. If, you know, the folks in Washington, D.C. have no idea what's going on in Knox County, Tennessee. And if you look around our country and you think about federalism, the founders had this idea, of course, that the states would be, as Jefferson called them, experiments in liberty, and you'd have different states and different things all across the country, and people could vote with their feet to move to the place which actually worked better. In my opinion, that would be the place which is more free, or free in whatever different way that might attract you. And I think that's actually one of the problems that we see across the country. Our country is extremely divided. And if you think about it, the folks in New York and the folks in California, we're different here in East Tennessee than they are. And there's nothing wrong with us being part of one country, of course. I think the problem is we have these one size fit all policies that come out of Washington that force us all to live the same way. And that's not what the founders had in mind. And I think that the differences within our country are such that now, you know, we're really seeing those bubble up. And so much of that is due to we have this overarching federal government, which is so powerful that, you know, the things that come out of Washington have such an impact on our everyday lives. And here in East Tennessee, of course, we would consider many of those things a threat because we're pretty libertarian here. Okay. You know, some folks might think that we're, you know, a bunch of super social conservatives, but that's actually not the case. People here are pretty much keep my taxes low and, you know, have a good police force, but otherwise leave me alone. I mean, that's really what a lot of folks here want. So when we have policies that are coming out of even Nashville, but Nashville's here, that's our state capital there. You know, our state's pretty good. Our state government actually pains me to praise politicians as a libertarian, but our state government has done a good job, and you can see that as far as what's happening now. We're seeing a migration of folks and companies and businesses out of the high tax, high regulation jurisdictions to places like Tennessee. So even though that is still not perfect, I think the fact that when we have more power at the local and state level, it gives people the opportunity to explore. They have the opportunity to go somewhere where they feel much more comfortable. Whereas now there's so much like homogenized policies around the country. You know, you go anywhere and some things are the same. And I will say that with the pandemic, we have seen like in Tennessee, of course, South Dakota, Florida, we haven't had the massive government overreach that we've seen in places like New York, Michigan, and California. And I think people here really do appreciate that. And I think a lot of people from those places appreciate it too, and they're moving here.
Right. And one other thing about the COVID-19 pandemic is with more people working remotely than ever, there's even more of an ability to vote with your feet. I read this morning in the Wall Street Journal about Austin, Texas, seeing an influx of people from California and New York for lower taxes and a lower cost of living. So one, maybe if you could speak to how that's affected, have you noticed something similar in Tennessee? But two, do you think that federal policies like a $15 minimum wage or national rent control and some of the other things on the progressive wish list would erode the ability of states and localities to engage in this kind of federalist competition?
We have seen folks and people moving here from different parts of the country. Anecdotally, my wife is a realtor, and she sees that. And some of the folks that she talks to, you know, here we worry about, you know, the saying, don't Californiaize my Tennessee, right? Don't come here from a place like California where they have high taxes, high regulation, and all those things, and escape that by coming to Tennessee and then turn around and say, hey, you guys don't have all this stuff that I really like, and I like that in California. We need to raise taxes. And, you know, no, don't do that. Remember, you came here because of how we are here. Low taxes, you know, freedom of choice, all those sort of things. She sees that just anecdotally. And I think, too, when we look at the numbers, we can see that. And of course, Texas is booming. Elon Musk is talking about moving Tesla to Texas now. And there's a lot of things happening there as well. On your other point, yes, I do believe that anytime the federal government puts a policy such as any sort of national minimum wage, rent controls, even things like, you know, the income tax and even the Federal Reserve, it really homogenizes everything and takes the ability for the states to differentiate themselves away from them. And I don't think that's a good thing at all. I think that's actually very destructive. And I think that when we see states that are more liberty-minded, and they start doing well, that the issue is then the other states will start losing population and they'll turn to Washington and say, hey, we need these, you know, we need these policies at a national level. Or, you know, some of these states that have huge pension issues and debt, you know, my fear is they're going to go to the federal government and say, hey, we need like $1 trillion. And here in Tennessee, we're not in that situation. And what are the folks in Tennessee going to say when, you know, Illinois or California says we need $1 trillion to bail out our pension system? We're sitting down here saying our pension system is fine, and you're basically taking money from us to bail out another state. So unfortunately, I think with even bad decisions and bad policymaking at the state level, that is going to impact some things going forward.
So what about the question of state and local relief for COVID-19 and being included in federal stimulus? Is that, you know, just, is that fair game, or is that what you're talking about? Is that federal bailout of state and local competition?
Right. My issue with that, first of all, the federal government doesn't have any money, right? They've got, $27 trillion in debt already. Everything they're doing now is just printing money, which is going to have very detrimental impacts on our economy at some point, whether it's huge inflation rates, whether it's another crash because of malinvestment in the economy, whatever. So we have to remember, first of all, there's no money in the federal government.
That's your Austrian economics.
Yeah, exactly. but if they are going to hand out money, it needs to be done equally. And it doesn't need to go, you know, to whatever state to bail them out. And I think everyone, all of us conservatives and Republicans are looking at that going, you know, yeah, if you're going to send this money out. Now, in some cases, of course, you know, or even states that have, you know, shut down their economy, now they're turning to the federal government saying, hey, we need a bailout. Well, here in Tennessee, we haven't shut down our economy. So, you know, you guys are going to bail someone else out. And, you know, we've tried to do our best here and manage through this, realizing that the economy is people. And if you shut down the economy, that's killing people as well. So that's the issue with the bailouts is the fact that, you know, it could go to some of these states that have not shown fiscal restraint in the form of bailouts. And that would be very problematic for the rest of us, I think, who have shown a good deal of fiscal restraint.
So another kind of state and local issue that interests me, and I think interests a lot of libertarian-minded listeners, is this question of when states and localities offer special tax loopholes and benefits and crony deals to lure people and lure businesses into their area. So Have you or your state and local government engaged in any of that? And what do you think of that practice more broadly?
Here in Tennessee, that's mostly done at the state level. What we can do here at the local level is we can do, we don't do like tax, we don't give people tax money. We can do tax abatements with pilots and TIFs, which are a little different. And which means we actually, we wouldn't be collecting any tax money in any case. Okay. These are, say, if someone goes in and, you know, they're going to build a $50 million building, but currently they're moving into a $5 million building. We would keep the tax rate at $5 million, which is we would be collecting. So if they don't come, we're not collecting the money anyway. You know, but that's the pretty much the extent of what we can do at the local level. You know, and the state can do more than that. I'm not really a fan, of course, of that, because no one's going to pay someone, I don't know, $50,000 to open a restaurant. Okay, a mom and pop restaurant downtown. Okay, but they will pay a company millions of dollars or give them certain incentives to come here. So it's not fair to small business, and that stinks. On the other hand, a lot of what we deal with, and I've had to do this too, you know, we're not where we would want, not where I would want to be. Okay, we don't live in the libertarian world that, you know, that all of us would like to see. So anything that we can do to move towards that is great. But at the same point in time, we also have to compete with other places. That being said, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether the tax incentives are even the most important thing and even the deciding factor in what companies will do. And I think what happens too often is state and local people just throw the incentives out there because they think they have to, instead of negotiating and trying to get them there with minimal incentives and doing that first. But I certainly understand everyone's frustration, you know, when it comes to that, because, I mean, it isn't fair. I'll be the first to admit that.
So with that in mind, kind of just looking back, you were elected in 2018. What have you been able to accomplish since then from the libertarian perspective in terms of scaling back government where it was and didn't belong, or improving the efficiency of government from an outsider coming in?
Well, the most important thing, and this is, you know, as a mayor, as governor, whatever, people always want to hear about what you built and what you did. Most important thing I've been able to do is we've kept taxes where they're at. Okay, and we haven't had to raise taxes. In fact, we've been able to really solidify the budget and still deliver services while keeping the same level of taxation, which is a win. You know, we've done some things like we had a program, and it was called Indigent Care Program, and it was a pain. It was basically reimbursing hospitals for medical bills for folks that were, you know, well below the poverty line, and we were able to scale that back and save about $1.5 million on that. We have an $850 million budget. While still, you know, still, it wasn't like we kicked people out on the streets. There were just some inefficiencies within that program. Unfortunately, even though we have an $850 million budget, my hands are somewhat tied with about 90% of the budget, because in the state of Tennessee, we fund the schools, and there's really no you know, we have what's called a maintenance of effort that says this is how much money we have to get the schools. So the schools get 63% of our budget, and that's right off the top. And I have no say so, neither does county commission over how they spend that money. The sheriff's office, again, you know, this is he's an independent constitutional officer, so it's same deal. We have a debt service that the county. The county has, we take on the school's debt as well as our own debt. So it's pretty significant. My predecessor was a fiscal conservative, and he was able to make a dent in our debt. We have been able to take advantage of some refinancing that's actually saved us money. So for all the money that the Fed's printing, at least interest rates are low, so that's saving us money on our budget. And yeah, just looking at efficiencies, we've been able to cut down the number of county employees, as well as being able to take advantage of technology that I don't think had been explored before I came into office. I'm big into technical innovations that hadn't been explored before I came into office, you know, to really shore up some things. So a lot of the stuff that we've done has actually been kind of internal that folks may not look at and go, oh, that's really sexy and big. But it'll help us keep taxes hopefully where they're at for the foreseeable future.
So on that note, what do you think for people who are who look at state and local government sometimes see that it's less hyper-partisan and less tribal than federal politics? Have you witnessed that firsthand? Is that true, or is that just kind of a misconception that people have?
It is true, I believe, you know, because we're not, we don't talk about or we don't have policymaking authority over some of the really divisive issues, you know, that are at a national level. At the same time, I don't know if that's always good, because, you know, when I look at places like Minneapolis and Portland and some of the things happening because they have a very left city government, that scares the dickens out of me. So even here, you know, our folks who are on the left, you know, they're not on that fringe that to where they're calling, you know, for defunding the police and, you know, doing some of the, you know, just the really crazy things that we see happening in some of these other communities around the country. So I'd say all in all, I'm extremely lucky to be here in Tennessee where, you know, we still have what are called yellow dog Democrats, which are fiscally conservative Democrats, which you don't see around much of the rest of the country anymore. So we're very fortunate, I think, all in all, to have people on both sides of the aisle that actually have a lot of common sense.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time so much. That wraps it up for our serious portion. Now I have to ask you the bonus question that I ask every guest, because I'm known for my controversial food opinion. So what is your opinion about food, a food you like, a food you hate, that you think will rile up the listeners, Mr. Mayor?
Oh, man, it's got to be the fact that I do not believe that pineapple and ham belong on the same pizza slice, unless it's actually like in Hawaii. I just can't go for that. I don't believe that fruit belongs on a pizza.
I think you'll find some people that will agree with that. But with that, oh, sorry, go ahead.
That's a 50-50. Half the people will get mad. Half the people will agree with it.
And with that, I will let you go. Thank you so much for your time. All right, everybody, that's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. And make sure you're subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Go ahead and leave us a 5-star rating review if you can. If you can, it really helps. Thanks, and we'll see you all again next week.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.